the EU and me. Brought to you with the support of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Communicating Europe Initiative.
Yes, indeed. A very good morning to our panel for EU and Me. This is where we're talking about Ireland's membership of the European Union, 50 years since we joined, and the changes across all sections of our society. This morning we're talking about how it's changed the way that we work, how it continues to change the way that we work. I'm delighted to say we have SIPTU economist and researcher Michael Taft with us. We have Barbara Gerstenberger, head of unit for working life with Eurofound, and we also have Caroline Reedy, regular contributor here to us from the HR suite. Good morning to all of you, and thanks for joining us on the programme. Michael, if I can start with you, first of all, it's been remarkable, the changes that have happened anyway, I suppose, over the last 50 years, but you can't really look at how work life has changed here in Ireland in terms of the way we work, the standards we have, unionisation, all of those things, without looking at the influence of the European Union on it all, I suppose.
That's correct. I mean, ever since we joined over 50 years ago, the experience has been, for the most part, positive, but it has been uneven. In other words, it's been kind of a game of three halves, if you will. In the more positive features has been, a large number of directives and legislation emanating from the EU, which covers such a wide range of working conditions, such as working time, family supports, equality, health and safety, information and consultation. You have the European Works Councils, protections for Social Security, and protection for workers when one business sells to another business, keeping their rights. And if you think of this as being coupled with billions of euros of infrastructural investment during the 80s and 90s that came from EU structural and cohesion funds, this is what, modernized the Irish infrastructure at the time. However, on the flip side, during the 2000s, the EU pursued financial deregulation, which led to the crash in the financial sector. And this crash is where the EU showed its ugly face. It pursued austerity. It demanded a dismantling of collective bargaining regimes, which weakened workers' organizations and their bargaining power. And let's never forget that the EU Commission, along with the IMF and the ECB, essentially declared war on the people of Greece and Portugal through their troika demands. Now, they subsequently apologized. They said austerity was a mistake, but that really didn't undo the damage. But recently, in the last few years, the EU Commission seems to have reversed course, and there's two particularly progressive measures which are on the table. The first is the EU Directive on Adequate Wages and Collective Bargaining, and that will be a huge challenge for the government because it will require governments to ensure that 80% of all workers are covered by collective agreements. And just recently, late last year, they published a new draft legislation to ensure gig workers would get a minimum wage, access to sick pay, holidays, and general employment rights. Those are the three areas that we can look at. But on the whole,
The loopholes in those areas. Michael, you're talking there about the directives, the regulations affecting workers' rights, the right to work and travel in other EU states as well. This has all, have had a big impact on how people work, but also on employers. And bringing in all these regulations is fine, and I know it's been tied to structural funds, but there is also that need to make sure that those new regulations don't stifle business. Has the balance been gotten right there, do you think?
Oh, no, these regulations do not stifle business. They actually promote good business practice.
Let me put it this way. The change can be costly and more onerous in terms of work practices and rights for employees, and businesses would throw their hands up and say, look, how am I going to afford this? Parental leave, extra things like that. No, they find a way, ostensibly. But when you're considering all those things, the EU has had to consider that too, I'd imagine.
Oh, well, don't forget, the EU, it's not like the EU Commission sits in a bubble and makes these kind of decisions. It's not a bureaucratic exercise.
Sure.
There is extensive consultation with the trade union representatives of all the EU countries and the employer representatives. So in many cases, not in all cases, but in so many cases, these directives, this legislation is published on the basis of consensus.
Consensus including workers, employers. Workers. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Barbara Gerstenberg, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us on EU and Me. You're head of unit for working life at Eurofound. Can you tell me what Eurofound is and what it does, first of all?
Sure. So Eurofound is an EU agency, and we're based in Dublin. The full name of the organization is the European Foundation for the Improvement of Living and Working Conditions, and that tells you already a little bit more about what we're doing. Our task is to provide evidence, to provide facts and figures and analysis to policymakers so that they can then take better informed decisions, and they can devise these policies, and Michael Taft already mentioned a few of them, that will in the end contribute to improved living and working conditions for everyone in the EU. And now when I say policymakers, it's first and foremost the EU level, so it's the European Parliament, the Commission, the European level social partners that pick up on our research, but also national organizations and national governments, including the Irish government, because it can be very useful to look at, you know, what other countries are doing, how they are solving common problems, how your own country compares to other member states. And that's exactly what we can provide, policy pointers, advice, based on results of comparative research.
Sure. So how do we, in terms of the impact of EU membership on the workplace, how does the Irish workplace compare and conditions for workers compare with other EU states?
Well, when we look at working conditions and job quality, it's actually pretty much a good news story for Ireland. Now, you have to remember, job quality is, of course, a rather complex thing. There's not just one thing, one feature that makes a job a good job. So yeah, you want good working time arrangements, you want a safe workplace, you want a good social environment, you know, support from colleagues and bosses, etc. You want acceptable levels of work intensity, prospects, etc. So you can have these different dimensions, and when you then look at the jobs in Europe, about 20% of them on average perform really badly in all these dimensions that I've just mentioned. So those are really, truly poor quality jobs. So 20% of jobs in the EU, but only 12% of jobs in Ireland fall into this category of poor quality jobs. Now, you can argue that's still too much, absolutely,
yes, yeah,
but better than the EU average. And on the other side of the spectrum, when you look at the really well-performing jobs, the high-flying jobs, well-paid, a good physical environment, good social environment, good prospects, etc., EU average, again, roughly one-fifth, 21%. Ireland, 28% in that category. So good jobs in Ireland, higher than the EU average. Poor quality jobs, lower than the EU average. Also quite good results for work-life balance, for example. More people in Ireland than in the EU average for the EU average say that their working hours fit well or very well with their non-work requirements. But you have a relatively high gap between working hours, so paid work, between men and women in Ireland, higher than in many other member states. And you have one of the highest shares of people in the EU saying that they cannot work, or they cannot work full-time because of care responsibilities.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is linked to the problems with childcare provision, etc., in Ireland.
Yeah.
So these are just a few pointers.
Yeah, very interesting. Barbara, stay with us on the line. We have Caroline Reedy of the HR suite as well. Caroline, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure as always, Gerry. Thank you.
Some of the things we're doing well in there from Barbara, some of the things we're not doing well in across the European Union. What's your general view on how things have changed and the impact, I suppose, of European Union directives on the way we work in Ireland today?
I think it's been really, really positive overall to bring us into the modern world of work and to what is really an acceptable baseline standard. I suppose our 40 plus pieces of employment law, the majority of them have come from the EU and been transposed into Irish legislation. And as a result, I think we have overall a much better quality of working life. And I think that has helped with the making Ireland a really great place to live and work. And if we didn't have that high standard, I think that would really challenge us from a competitiveness perspective globally. And ultimately, I think it's all good. I think as well, we're starting to lead the way in many areas in relation to diversity, inclusion, you know, dignity and respect, those kind of areas, because the baseline, you know, we're starting to see is exactly that, a baseline. So we're starting to raise the bar in relation to seeing the huge benefits in relation to equality, diversity, like Barbara said there, females in the workplace starting to think differently in relation to flexibility. All those kind of things will positively support that. So I think overall, the whole piece of guidance in terms of those legislative directives, etc., has been all good, and we've a long way to go in certain areas, as Barbara highlighted. Yeah. However, we've a very strong foundation.
Okay, from which to build on. Caroline, to your view, the impact of the freedom to work and travel in other EU states, what's that meant for the workplace and individual employees and employers indeed in this country?
I think that it's probably one of the best opportunities, particularly for young people, graduates, or people who want to just experience, you know, different opportunities to work. It's made it so much easier for people to travel freely within the EU and also to transfer within subsidiaries, etc. And I suppose that has really helped from Enterprise Ireland, the IDA and others to promote that Ireland being a global brand in that regard. And I think, you know, we're very much seen on the world stage as such as that, particularly with our English speaking and, you know, now with the UK and Brexit, you know, I think we've got a strong opportunity around that. And I think multinationals, particularly from the US and abroad, you know, see Ireland as a really great foundation and a great opportunity to set up head offices here, as we've seen, to do with our corporation tax and other reasons, but also that ability to work more freely within the EU. So they might see Ireland as a starting point to facilitate that growth within Europe as a result. And I think making that, I suppose, much easier for people to do has really enhanced that opportunity, both for individuals and for corporations that are looking to grow within Europe.
Michael, I put that same point to you, the freedom to travel and move within the European Union. It's not come without its challenges, but it has provided opportunities for individuals to travel, to move, to get through the bureaucracy, the visa requirements that were there that were preventing it in the past.
Well, there's no doubt that the ability of Irish people to move abroad and also to keep certain rights like Social Security and all that, so to work abroad for a period and come back, it is, you know, it provides a huge social capital for the Irish economy, people's experience of other economies, and they bring this back. Also make the point that immigration into Ireland, which has its, you know, has its challenges. We know that certainly, of course, with the rise of Ukrainian refugees. However, on the whole, in terms of the economy, immigration is a positive thing. It builds diversity in. People bring new skills, new perspectives, and it can be a growth thing. However, that requires protections in the workplace. It requires protections across different sectors, especially the low-paid sectors, so that immigration cannot be used as a tool for exploitation. But yeah, on the whole, both immigration and immigration, that flow, free flow of people, their ideas, their skills, that can be a positive for the Irish economy.
Yeah, certainly can. We've seen that happen over the last number of years. If you have a view on what we're talking about here, we're talking about EU and me. We have a survey to remind you as well in relation to your views and how things have gone over the last 50 years or so, where they need to be in the next 50 years. Then get in touch with us on the programme. We'll be talking a bit more with Michael Taft, Barbara Gerstenberger and Caroline Reedy about this and how things have changed due to COVID in the workplace as well, how they may continue to change in the future, both from a policy direction and a reality direction. That and more on the way after we take these.
The EU and Me, brought to you with the support of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Communicating Europe Initiative.
Yeah, we're looking at Ireland's membership of the European Union and how it's changed us as a country over the last 50 years or so. We're concentrating on employment and how employment and working has changed in this country during that period. We've sipped to economist and researcher Michael Taft with us on the line, Barbara Gerstenberger, head of Unit for Working Life with Eurofound, and Caroline Reedy of the HR Suite. Barbara, if I can talk to you, I suppose the last couple of years, the way people are looking at and the way people are thinking about how we work has completely changed, really, brought about by the shock of COVID and what it did to all of us. You've been doing research on the effects of all of that. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. And I'd say, what the pandemic really showed us are, it's two things. On the one hand, the massive surge in remote work has shown us what is possible in this regard. And it's very hard to imagine that this will not have a lasting impact. It's hard to imagine that we're going to go back to pre-pandemic levels of remote working and teleworking, which was, something like 2 or 3% of the workforce who regularly worked from another place than their employer's premises. So why do we think it's not going to go back to these levels? It's because, first of all, it's very, very clear that workers liked it. They liked it because they had more flexibility to organize their work. They had more autonomy. They had better ways of combining work and non-work commitments. So workers liked it, and they say very clearly, we would like to continue. Not necessarily every day, but several times a month or a week working from home is what workers want. And then employers, I think, companies also realize, well, this works. There is no drop in productivity. So it's also good for the company. So I do think that is one of the lasting changes that we're going to see, which also means that we have to get more serious about tackling the risks associated with this form of working. And these risks we did see before, but now that so many people started to work remotely, they have become even clearer. So the risk of working longer hours than you would do at the employer's premises, the risk of working during your free time, so you do not stop at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock at 7, you have the laptop at home, you can log on again at 8 or 10.
You're always on, right?
Exactly. So that's exactly it, this blurring of boundaries between work and non-working life. And that needs to be addressed because we know that is not good for your health. And from the employer's perspective, it could also in the long term have then a negative impact on productivity. Workers who feel stressed are not as productive, are more likely to go on sick leave, etc., than workers that are able to have a good a balance between work and non-work commitments. And the second point that I think the pandemic has really, really shown us is that many of the jobs that kept society going during the pandemic, so those working in healthcare, in care, in retail, in transport, or the delivery people, in refuse collection, those are jobs that up to then we did not value very highly. They are providing poor conditions, very often badly paid, little social recognition, and that is also something that needs to be addressed, and the pandemic has made that very clear.
Okay. Michael, do you think we're on the road to addressing those sort of things, or addressing the changed way in which employees in particular, but also employers, are viewing post-COVID work?
Well, one would hope so. I mean, I Barbara is correct insofar as there are upsides and downsides to hybrid and remote working. The problem is that we don't know what the government intends to do to bring in the right for workers to work away from the office for a certain period. They did bring in legislation earlier this year, but there were so many opt-outs which the employer could take advantage of that they've had to they had to withdraw it and start from scratch. So we don't know to what extent we can embed hybrid working into a right which workers can take advantage of. And I just really want to emphasize the second point that Barbara made. People did begin to appreciate in a way that, okay, they were aware of, but it really came home that so much of the essential work that was done to keep the economy and society going was done by low-paid workers. Now, there's a positive step. It's a small step, but the government wants to increase the minimum wage to what is known as 60% of the median wage.
Yeah.
However, that's still a long way from a living wage. So we're making some progress on that. But what we need to do is have a national commitment to abolish hourly low pay. That would be consistent with introducing a living wage, so that the work that has that was done and continues to be done and will be done in the future by those who make a meaningful contribution to the economy and to their workplace, to their employer, that they are remunerated to a level to it so that at least they can have an affordable living standard.
Yeah, Mike, there's a certain wider question of and this no doubt will be occupying policymakers' minds as well, particularly maybe at government rather than EU level, or maybe I'm wrong. The changes, if they do become embedded, and depending on the percentage of people who used to go to the office who no longer go, particularly for our larger cities, you're seeing it, and we're seeing it already anecdotally, fewer people using public transport, fewer people going into city centres, more cafes, restaurants, shops closing down as a result of the lack of business. That's leading to unemployment in certain sectors increasing. But also then, on the flip side, the places where people move to, you might see a rebalancing of, you know, more places opening up, more jobs. There is a transition period that we're in that'll have to be watched very closely.
Well, that's correct. I mean, in all these things, there are transitional points. Now, I live in the inner city of Dublin and have seen the issues that you've raised with people certainly, you know, not coming in as often as they did. But here's then the challenge for, say, Dublin inner city is to make it a living city again.
Yes.
To, you know, ensure that there are people actually living in the city centre, which can then promote consumer spending in shops and restaurants and pubs.
Change the infrastructure, the planning and the arrangements to realise that this space, this inner city, is now used in a different way from what it has been for the last 30 years.
Absolutely. I mean, we've heard talk, throughout cities, throughout Europe, they've talked about the 15-minute city, which means that anybody living in a city should be within 15 minutes walking distance of shop, restaurant, schools, etc. In other words, you bring people back into the city center. It shouldn't be something whereby it's only alive during the day when people work and then everybody goes back.
And on the flip side of all of that, changing, I suppose, and the planning and the requirements in smaller towns in places like Kerry to reflect maybe more people working remotely for major companies. I'm going to talk to Caroline. Caroline, from your own business, how much of your time and your staff's time is taken up now by these sort of questions, the way COVID has changed people's perceptions, employers' requirements, employees' demands, and others in terms of how we work?
I think the fact that attraction and retention now is one of the key priorities for any business, that the new world of work that involves that hybrid and remote being core to that in jobs, that works. People are transitioning to get used to how do you manage people differently? How do people manage their productivity differently? How do we make time in the office meaningful? So that's focused on developing connectedness, you know, developing collaboration, teamwork, culture, etc., brainstorming. And then when people are at home, they're doing the deep thought work. So they're not just in the office on Teams meetings all day, every day, that they could be doing at home.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the new legislation that, again, has come from Europe around the right to disconnect, the whole focus on the new dignity and respect, bullying, harassment, etc., all of that has supported employers in trying to be proactive at addressing new challenges that are coming now.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I suppose, responding to that proactively. But it is challenging in this transition period, no doubt.
Yeah. Caroline, I'll ask you, and I'll ask the other two, this one final question. What are your hopes 50 years from now as to how we work and how the EU integrates in that?
Oh, wow, that's a brilliant question, Gerry. I think we're already seeing that people are prioritising work-life balance. And I think in time to come, flexibility will facilitate people to work when suits them. And the model of work will be very, very flexible and much more suiting people's responsibilities for caring, whether that's children or older parents, or whether they want to do a yoga class or Pilates, they want to take more time off at certain periods of the year. I think flexibility and work-life balance is the most exciting prospect to come.
Okay. And Barbara, same question to you. 50 years from now?
50 years from now, well, I would hope all jobs are good jobs,
safe from physical, but also psychosocial risks like too much stress, intimidation, etc. Providing fulfilling and meaningful work, I think, is also something we should hope and aspire for. You know, that the job gives you a feeling that I'm doing my work well, I'm doing useful work. I think this is what especially young people now are also very much looking for. As Caroline said, a high degree of flexibility when it comes to where to work, how to organize one's work, how much to work. And on this latter point, I would really hope for a shorter working day, shorter working weeks. We're now discussing the possibilities and the advantages of a four-day week. I would hope that in 50 years' time, a three-day week probably would be enough to produce all the goods and the services that we need.
There's an interesting perspective indeed. Barbara, thanks a million for that. And Michael, same question to you finally.
That we move towards a business model which is employee-centered. And Barbara mentioned some of those things, especially the reduction of the working week, living wage, right to hybrid working. And it's so important for employees to gain the right to collective bargaining, which yeah. workers in other European countries have. I just make this final point. It's great that we would have EU support, but we do not have to rely on the EU to deliver these things. These are political issues which we can solve here in Ireland.
Without waiting to be told what to do in terms of being forced to do it on that line. Michael, interesting one. Jim, there's work to be done on the rules and regulations of today. Jim O'Sullivan in Killarney worked in Germany for years, is now retired to his home country, Ireland. Because he worked all his life in Germany, he has what's called an EU entitlement to healthcare. Basically, it allows him to have a medical card in Ireland. But Jim says certain sectors of the HSE have repeatedly failed to recognise this and still insist on reviewing him regularly, when in fact all they need to know is he alive or is he dead? Well, there you go. There's a little bit of the bureaucracy that needs to be worked out of the system. Thanks for that, Jim. Finally, Trasa Murphy's with me in our studio in Tralee. Trasa, tell me about our survey.
Yes, Jerry, we announced this back in June, and just to remind people, we're still running it. We're asking you to take part in an online survey to get your views as to whether you think Ireland has benefited from joining the EU 50 years ago when we did that vote, and if so, in what ways has Ireland benefited or not? We'll present the findings in next month's edition. Links are on Radio Kerry Facebook today and on the Kerry Today Twitter page, and if you want to go to radiokerry.ie/euandme, radiokerry.ie/euandme. You'll be asked a series of questions along consumer rights, economy, the environment, agriculture, fisheries, freedom of movement. To get your thoughts on that, we'll be bringing you the results next month. So the survey, go to radiokerry.ie/euandme.
Great stuff. Thanks very much for that, Trasa. My thanks to economist researcher Michael Taft, Barbara Gerstenberger, head of unit for Working Life with Eurofound, and Caroline Reedy of the HR Suite.